This sermon was delivered at Grand Avenue Baptist Church, a gospel-centered church in Ames, Iowa. Hear more sermons and learn more about Grand Avenue at gabcames.org.
Good bit to try to cover today, so we'll probably just go ahead and jump into it. We're going to be skipping over Ruth, if you're paying attention to the table of contents as we're working through this. We'll come back to Ruth. We're going to tackle Ruth when we get to the Psalms. Kind of to explain why we would do that would kind of be to explain Ruth, so I can't really do that right now. But we'll get to Ruth when we get to the Psalms. I know it's there. I'm not skipping it, just for now. I'm going to come back to it later. We're going to jump into 1 Samuel, 2 Samuel, 1 Kings, 2 Kings is going to be our content for this week. So as a quick note, really this is kind of more like two books than four books. So 1 Samuel, 2 Samuel, 1 Kings, 2 Kings, the reason those are divided is really has to do with the kind of literary capacity of ancient writing techniques. So fun fact, Hebrew originally didn't have vowels. It was just consonants, and so vowels were added and kind of standardized in like the 4th, 5th century AD. So when 1 Samuel was, or when Samuel was first written, Kings was first written, it only had the consonants. So about half as many characters as it would have had to have when it got translated into Greek, which does have vowels, all of a sudden a kind of a decent-sized scroll became a huge scroll, right, because now it was twice as long. So that's why they cut it into 1 Samuel, 2 Samuel, 1 Kings, 2 Kings, just for having too big of a scroll to carry around. So that's kind of where that comes into. So 1 Samuel just rolls right into 2 Samuel. And then Kings picks up where Samuel leaves off. These are two just narrative cover to cover books. So Kings, it's a distinct book, but it picks up the same story kind of right where Samuel leaves off. Kind of does a little bit of backtracking, you know, kind of a little bit of a, you know, last week on, you know, kind of a thing. The first couple of chapters, but picks up the same story. So that's what we're going to be covering. Is just going to try to run through this. So really all I'm going to try to do today is walk through the story beginning to end, and try to tease out some key ideas, but really just in telling the story, I think I'm going to be trying to just help you understand some of the main thrusts of what's going on here. So really what these books do, Samuel and Kings, is it looks back on the rise of the Davidic line, King David, and it remembers the faithfulness of David and of Solomon and a few other highlight kings, and the way that God profoundly blessed the nation through their faithfulness. But it also remembers their failures and their sins of the exact same kings and traces the division of the nation and eventually the destruction of the nation to the failures of those otherwise faithful kings. Right, so it's kind of the point, why these books do this is that it's trying to set you up to look forward in hope to a new and better son of David who's going to restore the nation and bring about the worldwide blessing through his perfect righteousness and perfect faithfulness. So the point of these books is that God is going to fulfill his promise. Remember, we've kind of been hitting that like threefold promise that we've been talking about a little bit from Genesis, where God is going to make Israel a great nation, going to give them the land, and through them cause worldwide blessing to come to all nations. So what these books are trying to teach us, trying to help us to keep in mind, is that we're going to need a better king than King David. As good and as faithful as he was, we're going to need someone who wasn't just mostly faithful, mostly righteous, but someone who is perfectly righteous. a sinless king to redeem and lead the people of God, who is going to come from the line of David. So we're supposed to remember the faithfulness of David, national glories that come through him, but also remember his sin and his failure that was repeated through his sons, so that we would look forward in hope to an even better David who's going to fulfill God's purposes in and through Israel. So basically the story picks up right where Judges leaves off. The nation is in a state of wickedness, state of chaos, because of wicked and chaotic leaders. We meet a leader early on named Eli, who's the priest at the tabernacle at Shiloh, and his sons are just deplorable. They're just awful, awful men. And we see God eventually cut that line off, I think all in one day. So we see the leadership of Israel being shown to be chaotic and wicked. And so then an interesting kind of a bookend to help you understand at least the book of Samuel is Hannah's prayer in the second chapter of Samuel and David's song at the very end of Samuel. So I want to point out, I want to read just a couple of those verses to help you see kind of the key thrust that Samuel wants us to keep in mind as we're reading this book, just to understand what's going on in the middle. So 1 Samuel 2, 1 through 3. I'll read that and just kind of hear, try to catch some of the main ideas. She prays, "My heart exults in the Lord, and my horn is exalted in the Lord. My mouth derides my enemies, because I rejoice in your salvation. There is none holy like the Lord, for there is none besides you. There is no rock like our God. Talk no more so very proudly. Let not arrogance come from your mouth, for the Lord is a God of knowledge, and by him actions are weighed." So that's Hannah's prayer at the very beginning of 1 Samuel. And then at the end of 2 Samuel, I'm going to read verses 1 and 2, and then in the verse 28 as well, to just kind of help you see some of those themes. So there, David sings, "The Lord is my rock and my fortress and my deliverer, my God, my rock in whom I take refuge, my shield and the horn of my salvation, my stronghold and my refuge, my Savior, you save me from violence." And then verse 28, he says, "You save a humble people, but your eyes are on the haughty to bring them down." That haughty more or less means prideful. So basically the idea is that God is going to save the nation when it humbles itself and is led by a humble and faithful king. So then we get into the story. The first 9 chapters of Samuel is basically kind of Israel pre-monarchy, before the rise of the first king. And this kind of tells the story of how Saul became king. If you're looking at that timeline, you can see there's kind of a little bit of things are getting better under Saul, but then they start getting worse under Saul. So then after that, chapter 10 through 31 is the kind of the rise and fall of Saul, including the introduction of David and his time as a fugitive fleeing from Saul. This is where we see that Saul gets rejected because he's not willing to listen to God and to obey God. And we see basically that the people want a king to give them material security and prosperity. Right, and so then we see that instead of a king like Saul, that God is going to appoint a very different kind of king who's going to be faithful to him and to obey his word. So we pick up in 2 Samuel, chapters 1 through 10, is basically the story of the prosperity of David's rule, that kind of things are going pretty well. And then in this, we get in chapter 7, we get the promise of a Davidic line. This is a really significant kind of moment in the history of Israel, where basically David says, all right, the enemies have been subdued around Israel, the land has been secured, God's blessing is starting to come onto Israel. So, all right, God, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to build you a house. I'm going to build you a temple. It's going to be glorious. It's going to be amazing. Finally, you're going to have a house worthy of your name. And God says, no, you're not going to build me a house. You've shed too much blood. Someone else is going to build me a house. But actually, I'm going to build you a house. I'm going to build you a house. And so there's kind of we do it in English too, but there's a word play going on there where house can mean both temple. Right? David's saying, I'm going to build you a physical temple. But what God is saying to David is, I'm going to build you a dynasty, a line, a lineage, right? So if you talk about, so when we're talking about like the house of David, we're not necessarily talking about his, you know, brick and mortar palace that he lives in, but we're talking about David and his son and his son and his son, the lineage of David, the dynasty of David. And so there's a little bit of wordplay going on there where God is saying to David, I'm going to build you a dynasty. I'm going to build you a lineage of kings from and through you. And we get this promise where we see that line is never going to end, that there's always going to be a king on the throne of David. And then we get to the peak. If you're looking there on your little timeline there, things are going really, really well under David. And then all of a sudden something happens. And things from this moment to Daniel are downhill. Downhill into turning away from the Lord, into faithlessness, into destruction, eventually into exile and being sent away from the land. So in chapters 11 through 12, we see the story of David and Bathsheba. This is where David commits adultery with Bathsheba. She gets pregnant. He has her husband murdered through, you know, murder by opposing army. to cover it up. Right. And so we see this faithfulness and this blessing coming through this king. And then all of a sudden, in his arrogance, in his pride, he turns away from faithfulness. And what we start to see, the rest of the story starts to show how this event is the turning point in Israelite history. This event is where Israel turns from increasing in blessing to moving towards God's judgment. So how does that fold out? Immediately after this, in chapters 13 through 20, we see that this adultery and murder leads to one of David's own sons following in his footsteps and committing rape, which then leads to himself getting murdered by another one of David's sons, which then that son, Absalom, then overthrows David, leads a coup against David, takes the throne from David, which then leads to civil war. But eventually, David is returned to the throne. That son is killed. But we get this interesting snapshot with kind of like a echo, smaller civil war in 2 Samuel 19, 41 through really most of chapter 20, I believe. We see some verbiage where this is the first time, because of this civil war, this is the first time that we see language about Israel in the north and Judah in the south. All of a sudden, this civil war creates divisions within Israel. The nation doesn't split quite yet, but the divisions are there. All of a sudden, there's an identity. They even say things. Let's do that. Could I have somebody read 2 Samuel 20, verse 2? Oh, I'm sorry. Could you actually verse 1? Yeah, sorry about that. Right, so we see that exact same language gets brought back up when the nation actually does split. This is the same refrain that the 10 tribes of Israel rally around to break off from the house of David. So the point being, this isn't just kind of random events kind of going south, right? What Samuel and eventually Kings wants us to see is that this adultery with Bathsheba, this murder of Uriah, is genetically linked step by step to the division of the nation and the exile of both halves of the nation. Right, so it's not just kind of like, oh, these kings in their vague faithlessness led to the exile of people. But actually, this king, faithful though he was, because he did not walk faithfully in everything, led the nation into division and destruction. So this is the kind of high point that leads to the low point, at least right after the high point. So then 20 through 24 covers David's final days, and then Kings picks up more or less where Samuel leaves off, kind of again recounts a little bit of David's reign. And then 3 through 10 is kind of the rise and glory of Solomon. And in a lot of ways, he's kind of set up as like even better than David, right? Even more glorious than David. So it's kind of this pressure of like, is this the son of David? Is it already him? Is it going to be him? Is he the son of David that was promised? But then in chapter 11, we start to see that Solomon himself turns away and is depicted as a second pharaoh. In a lot of ways, again, we see Solomon lusting after foreign wives to be kind of a picture of how Israel lusts after foreign gods. And so Solomon, through his gathering wives to himself, leads Israel into idolatry and faithlessness. And so again, we see it's not just that the kings weren't faithful enough to keep the nation in God's blessing, but actually led them astray. So chapter 12, we see Solomon lose the kingdom, or Solomon's son lose the kingdom. And then again, notice the parallel with the end of David's civil war. Could somebody read 1 Kings 12, verse 16? So he's almost quoting from 2 Samuel, right? So it's the same rallying cry. What do we have to do with David? What stake do we have in David? Let's go to our own tents, O Israel. So these seeds of division, this wasn't just Solomon's fault. It wasn't like things were great in Israel before Solomon. These were seeds that David had sown. So the rest of Kings really is a kind of steady decline of both halves, Israel and Judah, into increasing wickedness and chaos, ending for both in exile from the land. 14 through 22 is the histories and dynasties of Israel and Judah. 17 through 22 is the story of Ahab, Jezebel, and Elijah. We're not going to have time to. There's something I want you to see in there. It's on your outline, but I don't think we're going to have time to get to that. 2 Kings 1 through 7 is kind of the end of Elijah's ministry. Elijah and then Elisha is his ministry through most of those chapters. Those are two key prophets. Both of those prophets in the north in Israel. And then 8 through 17, we see more histories of the kings kind of moving in a steady downhill direction. And then in chapter 17, we see the fall of Israel to Assyria in 723 BC. Then 18 through 25 is basically just Judah's independent history. Judah alone, you know, Israel is no more. And so it's just Judah's story from that point forward. In 25, we see the fall of Jerusalem to Babylon in 586 BC. And that's basically the end of the story. We do get this interesting note at the end. That's one of the discussion things, so I don't want to dig in too much into it. It's just this interesting little note. Where the book actually ends is several years later, when the son of David, the current rightful king, is actually brought out of the prisons and is put into the king of Babylon's court, which is interesting. So it ends with almost at the very tail end of 25. Everything is dark. Everything is going terrible. The city's been destroyed. The nation's been put into exile. But then it fast forwards a little bit, and it says that one of the kings, the sons of David, is basically brought out of prison. So Jehoiakim put off his prison garments, and every day of his life he dined regularly at the king's table, and for his allowance, a regular allowance was given him by the king, according to his daily needs, as long as he lived. And so basically it ends in darkness, but it kind of gives us this little, you know, it's kind of that like mid-credits scene, right? Where it's kind of like, but there's still hope. There's still a glimmer. The line of David still is. And he's no longer in prison. Now he's at the table of the king. So it's just a glimmer, but there's a glimmer. So that's how it ends. So what I want to do kind of just the next few minutes together is walk through this timeline. Sorry, this Excel spreadsheet. So really what this is, on one side, it's the kings of Judah, and the other side, the kings of Israel. And really the idea is just to try to tease out how these kings are described, because each of them get like a one or two verse kind of summary statement from the Lord about God's judgment on what these, kind of a quick summary of what their reign was like. So a few things I want you to notice. So you can see across the top, just the details that are in there. There's the name of the king, the dynasty, right? So what line is this king coming from? When did their reign start? When did it end? That's kind of approximate. That's don't be too worked up about those. Those numbers don't be too worried about that. Duration, how many years they reigned, and then who their mom was. That's kind of interesting. Whether they were good or bad, and then a little bit of a quote from the scripture's actual assessment of them, and then a comparison. A lot of them get compared to somebody. You know, so-and-so was a good king, kind of like so-and-so, right? Or so-and-so was a bad king, like this other guy. And some of it is, we'll see some of that a little bit. It's just interesting to note who they get compared to. And then a lot of them get a caveat, right? So a lot of the good kings, especially in Judah, it's, he was a good king, but he didn't take away the high places, right? Kind of this idolatrous pagan worship location. So it's like, good king, but some real concerns. But some of them, it's interesting, even the bad kings get caveats. It's like, he was a wicked king, but not like Ahab. So it's kind of interesting how those caveats kind of can push both ways. So first thing I want you to notice is that the Israelite kings, none of them have moms. Of course, they have moms, but they don't get mentioned. Why? That's so strange. And what's interesting that you should probably note is that most of Kings is written more from the Israelite perspective than the Judah perspective. And so it's not like they don't have access to the information. Elijah, Elisha, those are both prophets to Israel, right? Ahab, the story of Ahab takes up a huge block of text in this. That's going on in Israel. So it's not like they're just ignoring what's going on in Israel. That's really interesting. Best speculation about why, at least according to my lights, about why Judah's king's moms get mentioned is something of that. The way that the promise in Genesis 3:15 is worded, I think, should kind of come back to mind of that specifically an offspring of the woman is going to crush the head of the serpent. Right. So somehow there's something that we're supposed to be reminded of that these sons of David aren't just sons of David, but they're actually, these are kind of eschatological offspring of the woman. And so, of course, their mom plays an important role in that. I don't know. It's just interesting that they get mentioned. Not all of them, but most of them get mentioned who their mom is. Let's see. Israel's kings, they're all different shades of bad. None of them get a good review. None of them get a good review. What's interesting is the last king gets the closest to a good review, right? So they're all kind of bad. You can see the dark red ones. Those are really bad. Hosea, at the end there, it says, he did what was evil in the sight of the Lord. But it says, but the kid's caveat is not like the kings of Israel before him. And so it's like, he was a bad king, but kind of more like the bad kings of Judah. Might be some of the suggestions. So it's interesting there. The kind of the last one is like, oh, glimmer hope. Oh, nope, exile. I don't know. It's interesting. The Judah's kings, they have their bright spot. Several are good, and a few are really good. So Hezekiah stands out. Josiah stands out. Several are said that they're good. They did right in the eyes of the Lord. But interestingly, the bad kings of Judah are worse than the bad kings of Israel. And I don't know if it's just kind of a harsher judgment because they have the line of David there or not, but it's interesting that you see this specifically because the judgment on the bad kings of Judah moves from he did what was wicked in the sight of the Lord, kind of he wasn't like David is kind of how it starts out, and then you get to Jehoram the first and Ahaziah the first, the red blocks, and it says that they were wicked kings, like Ahab, like the bad kings of Israel. But then you actually move down into the kings down at the very bottom end, looking at Manasseh and Ammon. It says that they did what was evil in the sight of the Lord, according to the Canaanites. And so the Israelite kings kind of go from bad to worse. And the Israelite kings go from, not as good as David to bad like the Israelite kings to as bad as the Canaanites who were displaced before them. Right? And they specifically mention child sacrifice in these descriptions, saying that they sacrificed their sons. They offered their sons to the fire, right? Like the Canaanites. That's a big part of why the Canaanites were taken out of the land. And so we see this trajectory of the kings of Judah from, they have the really high highs, but then really low lows. I think that's just interesting. Judah has 20 monarchs in 350 years. Israel has 20 monarchs in 200 years. Same amount of rulers, just a lot more turnover in Israel. Judah has one dynasty, all sons of David. Israel has 10 different dynasties. And a lot of them are not even really a dynasty. It's just kind of one guy, right? One guy kills the king, takes the throne. Some other guy kills him, takes the throne. It's just a lot of chaos in Israel. A couple of stories. I already touched on one, how Judah kind of moves from being within the blessing of the Lord to being like their neighbor Israel to being like the Canaanites. Touched on that already. I mean, this is interesting. I just wanted to note this. I was just really encouraged by this, and I thought this might speak to some of you as well. Notice in Judah, kind of the blue kings, for lack of a better term, that four kind of in the middle. So really, this stood out to me because I was trying to color code them, trying to figure out like ranking. How do they get? How's their kind of overall assessment? And these blue guys, they're interesting because the second one gets kind of the most explicit assessment of who of his quality. He says, he did what was right in the eyes of the Lord. All right, so that's a good assessment. He did what was right in the eyes of the Lord. It says, like Jehoash, his father, but not like David. Right, so this is kind of the caveat. He was a good king, like his dad before him, but not as good as David, right? So it's kind of a like mid-tier, definitely a good king. You know, you're happy with that. This is a, you know, above 500 record for your team, but you probably didn't make the playoffs, right? And so what's interesting to me is notice who his dad is and notice who his granddad is. Two of the kings who are specifically said that they're like the Israelite kings, like Ahab, which is very much not a good assessment. And so specifically this Jehoash has this interesting caveat made. So he has a really, really twisted story of just kind of like the world he was born into. So when his dad died, Ahaziah the first, his dad was Athaliah's son. And so Athaliah tried to kill the line of David, killed all of her presumably maybe other sons and nephews, and the sons of the other women that were her husband's wives. And so then she takes the throne for like 6 years. And this guy, Jehoash the first, is like a baby. He's as an infant. He's taken away and he's hidden for years, right, until he's a boy, I suppose. And eventually they overthrow this queen who'd taken the throne to herself and put him back on the throne. So really, like, that's your story. All of a sudden, 6 years old, you're the king of the nation, and just your family history is just chaos. And so we get this assessment. I think this is just beautiful. It says, he did right in the eyes of the Lord because Jehoiada the priest instructed him. And so he didn't have the example of his dad to learn how to be godly. And in his case, it's probably a good thing. Like, his dad got a very bad assessment. Right, his dad walked in the ways of Ahab. His granddad walked in the ways of Ahab. So he comes from a very ungodly line, right? But then he had a mentor. Someone stepped into his life and said, I'm going to teach you how to walk with the Lord. I'm going to teach you how to honor the Lord. I'm going to teach you how to rule in a godly way, how to live in a godly way. And he gets a positive assessment from the Lord. And then what's really beautiful is that so does his son and his grandson. And his great-grandson. There's just something really beautiful there that he was not born into an environment of godliness. He was born into a story of chaos and destruction. But because of the grace of God and an invested, loving mentor, he was able to live in a way that was good and godly and pleasing to the Lord. And he, from a legacy of godlessness, created and started a legacy of godliness. And so maybe that resonates with you. Maybe you're coming from a place where you didn't learn how to walk with the Lord in your home. Maybe you kind of like this guy, didn't know your dad at all. Maybe you did. Maybe he was a great guy, just didn't teach you how to walk with the Lord. Maybe he wasn't a believer himself. Maybe he was, just didn't know how to pass it on. Or for whatever reason, you're saying, man, I'm standing in a place in my family history where I just don't have godly resources behind me. And I don't know how to walk with the Lord. I don't have an example of a godly home. If I'm thinking about getting married, I have no idea what a godly marriage looks like. I'm thinking about having kids. I have no idea what raising kids in a godly home looks like. That can be intimidating. But what this reminds us is that through God's grace, you can be the beginning of a new story. That God can start a new story in your life where your kids can grow up in a godly home, learn to walk with the Lord from a young age. Their kids can grow up in a godly home, learn to walk with the Lord from a young age. Their kids, right? You can be the beginning of a new legacy. So I'd encourage you, if you feel like that's your place, press into the church, press into community, find your Jehoiada, find somebody and say, teach me, what does this look like? I don't know how to do this. Find your Jehoiada. So that's all I really have time for there. The story of Elijah on Horeb that I think is interesting. Look through those notes. Specifically, I just want you to note how how similar this is to Moses on Sinai. All right. So a lot of what Elijah is doing is Elijah is going to the same mountain that Moses got the Ten Commandments, the Mosaic Covenant on, And he's coming in this place where he's saying all of Israel has gone away. He's looking at the rest of his nation and saying everybody has abandoned the covenant. He specifically says all of our nation has abandoned the covenant. And he's kind of going to the Lord, going to the mountain of the Lord, basically saying, I know I'm a prophet, but don't you think I might be the prophet? Remember Deuteronomy 18:15? There's going to be a prophet like Moses who's going to bring a new covenant. And Elijah goes here, and we see this dramatic display of God's power that echoes what we see on Mount Sinai in a very similar way. It's fire, thunder, earthquake, right? All these things. And then we get this dramatic nothing. A thin silence. A low whisper. And God tells Elijah, yeah, just get back to work. Get back to work. There's 7,000 who haven't bowed the knees to Baal. Get back to work. Keep pointing people towards Moses. You're a prophet. You're not the prophet. And so this is why, again, on Mount Tabor, when Jesus, in Jesus' transfiguration, why Moses and Elijah are there when God says, this is my beloved son. Listen to him. This is the prophet. So look at those notes. See some comparison there. Hopefully that can be helpful for you. We're out of time for the discussion. Feel free to stay here and discuss those with those around you if you would like. There's some passages just to see some of these themes working out. But I'm going to pray, and we'll be done for the day. Feel free to stick around and have some discussion if you would like. Dear Lord, thank you so much. It's for your grace and your mercy to strengthen us, to know you and to love you. Thank you for your word and how your word guides us and leads us. Thank you for your spirit. Lord, above all, thank you that you are our shepherd, our prophet, our priest, and our king, that you guide us, you lead us, you protect us, you govern us. We need you, Jesus. We pray all this in your name. Amen.